soon be. Friends are forged on a dark road, heading out of town. We're headed there now.
If you search for this, you will find Stephen Jenkinson and Gregory Hoskins in the band. They've put together this thing called Nights of Grief and Mystery, and they've done it, performed to sold-out houses on three continents, most recently during the 26-city Nights of Grief and Mystery North American Tour 2018. It's a fascinating little combo platter for those whose, I don't know, I don't want to get too prolific too early on this, but whose souls are thirsty. You know, you go to, we've all been to a concert and enjoyed it, but we've all been to that concert and enjoyed it. And there's a huge difference. Just have a listen to how they deliver this soul nourishment.
We're modern. God knows we are. We're modern. And we're homeless. And we are confused by freedom. And so we've left them to themselves. Or to each other, or to God. As we ourselves seem to have been left, they say. Allow me to welcome you to the dust of uncertainty, and that stilled gaggle of opinion and of faith that is the ending of days. And welcome to your one true love that was wrangled from all those promises, all those betrayals, and all that octane of your younger days.
So Stephen Jenkinson was on my show a couple of years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. And as welcome we come to the end of the Drew Marshall Show after 16 years, I'm reflecting a lot these days. I'm thinking over guests that have rocked my world. And just because someone rocks my world, like, it doesn't mean, ooh, they were funny or there was a... No, the ones that really rock my world are the ones that left a pebble in my shoe. And they just... In other words, they were irritating.
In a good way.
That's
in
what I mean. Way. Stephen Jenkinson. He's an activist. He's a teacher. He's a farmer, don't you know? And he's the author of a new book, Come of Age, The Case of Elderhood in a Time of Trouble. Stephen Jenkinson has a master's degree in theology from Harvard University. You know, master's degree in social work in the University of Toronto. He's a former program director and medical school assistant professor. He's the subject of the National Film Board of Canada documentary film Grief Walker. But for now. And he's pebble in my shoe, Stephen Jenkinson. Sir, thank you. Welcome back.
Drew, if that's the sum total of my consequence in this world, that'll do.
Okay, you're also the kind of guy that makes an interviewer work, and that's what I love about this. Mm-hmm. And so I can't just come out with candy.
Okay.
Because you're going to crack the shell and try to get to the good chocolate center. That's what you do with conversations. But I have this also this fear of being too earnest and too ethereal and too reflective. And, you know, I've met people like that, and mostly in the yoga world, and they drive me nuts.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
So, well, can I start off just a little differently with you, please?
Sure, man.
Okay.
It's your show, and I'm all yours for the next while.
Okay, cool. Thanks. When was the last time you laughed so hard you almost peed yourself?
It was... in the green room before one of the last Grief and Mystery shows. I don't know which one. It was in Toronto, I think, which will get you laughing if you're able. And we were about to go on, and it was one of the last times in that long tour that you described. And there was just something about Hoskins and his his willingness to carry on regardless that was so heartbreaking that it was became hilarious. And I think we just laughed until we couldn't remember any longer how it started. And then we went out and killed the place.
Look, the reason I asked that of you is I have this personality type that can swim around in melancholy for quite a long time. Mm-hmm. But then I meet people who live in melancholy. And while I can take them in small doses, I don't want to hang out with them.
Okay.
And I'm just trying to figure out.
So we're not going on a date then, is what
well,
you're
saying? Well, no, but is that it? Like, do you swim around in melancholy all the time?
Hell no,
or are you a nut job?
No. No, look, here's the most common question that you won't ask me, I know. And it goes like this. You've seen a lot of death. Yes, I have. And so you've probably seen your own death as a result of all that work. And my answer is, yes, of course I have. Occupational hazard. Then they say, so you're good with it then? And I say, well, get behind me, Satan. That's what I say next. Because I have no obligation to be good with it just because I've seen a lot. And this will come to melancholy in a second. So then what's the alternative to, you know, knuckling under way before your time just because you've seen it? And the answer is, well, the great sort of mystery train of the whole operation is, at least for me, that I got a chance to see my own demise through the burdensome privilege of attending other people's demise. And the direct and enduring consequence of that is that I have begun to find life very habit-forming indeed and very compelling, and I have no interest whatsoever in the end, at least no interest in hastening it in any fashion at all. So I think that's the antidote. I think melancholy is a kind of privileged person's boredom, to be frank.
Really well said. Yeah, love
and
that.
Wow.
And we, you know, we owe the world more than that, given the immense good fortune of where we've been born.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you just said that, because that's a nice segue into another question that I have that might have some prickles to it. So just patience with me,
sure.
Please, if you can.
Sure.
You said this line, which I wrote down, I just stopped being somewhere else. And isn't that just something privileged people say? Like I had, who's the guy, Tim, I had on not too long ago, the big, when you're present and you're, I don't even know the words anymore, man. Anyway, I had some guru that Oprah had on and I thought he was interesting and he turned out to be really interesting and he was trying to get me to be more aware of just the now, right? And it wasn't, my question really is, in this world of self-reflection and yoga classes, and I'm going to pick on the yoga people a lot today because I wish I could grow a man bun and I can't. I just struggle with, this is so North American. The dude who's got 9 kids and they're all starving to death in whatever part of Africa you want to mention, they're not sitting around trying to find themselves.
I don't know what they're doing, but I'd guess I'd go along with you on that. That's probably true. Well, you know, let's back up. First of all, since we weren't, you or I, born in that part of Africa or that part of the world,
yeah.
What does this mean? Does this mean we're just perpetually adolescent, we're just suckers on the great tit in the sky? Is that it?
Yeah.
And if you look around, yes, but it's not inevitable. In other words, you could actually retroactively earn the immense and merit-free good fortune that you were born to some kind of relative ease and comfort. You could actually earn it, okay? But the only way to do that, seems to me at least, is to sign up for the recognition that it's so. And that if you just go for shame over that matter, there's no upside to anybody in the world to be ashamed of the fact you were born into a privileged circumstance. I know and you know that the word privilege is tantamount to a perpetual shamed inability to be an authentic human being. That's what it comes to. Well, maybe we could stop agreeing to go along with the notion that privilege immediately shames you and disables you for anything really consequential thereafter. But you got to work. And maybe the hallmark of the real privilege is the unwillingness to work. And work would be, from where I sit at least, it's the thing you're least inclined to do. So people are lucky enough to be born in a place where there's enough to eat, more than enough to eat. We simply have a responsibility that other places in the world don't have. And it's time to wake up. That's what that last book was about, finally, was trying to make the case to older people that by virtue of being older, you don't get to retire, man.
Yeah, another great line from you is, all elders tend to be older, but all older people are not elders.
Far from it, yeah.
You know, I do a regular segment on my show called Meanwhile Back on the Farm, and it stars my father, my 85-year-old father, who grew up on the farm. And life on the farm taught him more about life than Google ever will.
Surely.
And I realized that I want to sit at my father's feet. It took me 50 years, but I want to sit at my father's feet.
And he's still alive.
And he's still alive. So
well, see, there's some good fortune there.
Yeah. But I've also come across people who sell themselves as a bit of an elder.
Mm-hmm.
What's the term? The life coach.
Yes. And I was afraid you were going to say that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I find out they're under 40, and I just vomit.
Yeah.
And no wise person would ever call themselves wise. No elder would call himself an elder. It's up to the rest of us to find someone whose feet we want to sit at.
Indeed. Or admire, or envy for a time and then plow through that and get to the other side of it to approach something like wisdom. See, maybe it comes to this, apropos of life coaches. When I wrote the book, I sent it into the publisher, and then they submitted to a line edit, which is an exquisite torment that was thought of in some other more drastic time than this one.
Yeah.
And they subjected to something they called the Chicago-style manual, and I said, look, man, I'm a Canadian. I wrote the damn book in Canadian, so that's how that's going to stay.
Yeah.
They couldn't fathom that there was a Canadian language, but
Anyway,
somewhere in there, they wrote it back, and they said, you've got an aphorism here that you have not attributed, and we need the attribution. It's missing. And I looked it up, and I was the one who came up with it. But I guess it sounded so antique that they couldn't credit it to a living person, and this was it. You can decide if it had any merit or not. But I was rather proud of it at the time.
Sure.
It went like this. You start off in the light, and you end up in wisdom if the gods are prevailing. But otherwise, light. In other words, there's something about the ludicrous fascination with illumination, with all corners revealed, which the life coaches aid and abet, it seems to me. Which is the it's counterintuitive when you first say it, but it's the antithesis of wisdom. Wisdom knows the dark places very well, the shadowy bits. You know, it knows the adversary of life, which light junkies call the devil. See, or the white light Nazis call the devil.
Yep.
But in actual fact, it's the adversary. Or how about this one? It's the Antichrist. You hear this one, and, you know, don't let the born-agains own the word. Okay,
yep.
Because it's a perfectly legitimate once you understand where it comes from. We think anti means against, but what it actually means, the story, very quick, is, so here's this young man, and he didn't live very long, by all accounts, to his early 30s and no further. Now, you can get far up to your early 30s, but you can't cover immense distance, really, no matter who they say you are or were. So he only got so much done, right? And the word Christ was not the guy's name. They gave him that as an honorific title after he died. And he only got so much done. And guess what the Antichrist's job is? The rest. And when you put the two of them together, you got something like a whole story that you can run with, that you could live by. That's what I mean by adversary. Adversary brings the rest. And fundamentally, I think, that's what the elder function is, to bring the unwelcome, the unsought rest of the story so that we have no obligation simply to be okay all the time.
You know, here's one of the irritating things about interviewing you is that, when you're done talking, I'm still thinking, but I'm supposed to be talking because it's radio.
I know. But we got to trust the people who are listening, man. And, you know, 4 or 5 seconds of contemplation is not the same thing as bailing.
No, that's right.
Right?
That's right. So I am 52, a grandpa of three, and have just decided to put an end to 16 years of Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show. And people's first question to me is, what's next? And it's starting to get irritating. Oh, boy, I just seem very irritated today. Sorry about that. No, but it's, you know, what's next? What are you going to do? What are you, you know, because you pay the bills and you got to, what's your career? I mean, you're only 50. What's next? What are you going to do? And I don't know. I don't have an answer.
Yeah.
And it's really frustrating as a dude, as a North American dude, to not know what's next. I know there feels like there's a shame cloud approaching.
But Drew, you never knew what was next, man. That was a shell game. If you ever copped to having the plan and that it was working out, well, you might have had some people fooled, and you might have been one of them at various times. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't pretend to know you, but I think both of us could easily cop to the understanding that when we proceed with some confidence, it's mandatory smoke and mirrors sometimes, right? And eventually the odds are going to catch up with you. Just in terms of being bamboozled, that's all. Not the big one, yeah. But all the little ones before that. So, you not knowing what comes next is nothing new. But you had a show, you knew where where to come to every day. Well, that's something.
Yeah.
But if you didn't end it, somebody was going to. And
that's true. That's true. Yeah, I ducked that bullet for a few years. So, you know, I remember being in conflict resolution conversations with people who I thought were jerks and they thought I was a jerk. And as I sat in these meetings, the mediator would inevitably say to me, well, what do you want as a result of all of it? What would you like? What's the best outcome for you? And I remember one time saying, I'm not sure, but I do know that when I grow up, I want to be wiser than that guy. That was my way of being a jerk. But
yes, uh-huh.
But there is some truth to that. Okay, is it wrong for me, I was going to say for people, but is it wrong for me to have this dream of one day somebody might seek me out for some wisdom or some mentorage? I mean, it's so far off in the future, but when I grow up, I just want to be able to help others not put a bullet in their head.
Hmm. Yeah, the answer to the first part of your question is yes, provided you understand, and I understand, that wanting that day to come doesn't make it come.
No, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That if you don't spend all the time between now and then, you know, buckled up and strapped in, and especially to the understanding that anybody who's going to come to you in the years to come was not born into the same world that you were born into. Because, you know, given your age, you were on the last gasp of being born into a time where things were possible. You had an inherent feeling that if you just fill in the blank, you could probably pull it off. I don't think there's any kid born in the last 25 years who believes that for 5 seconds. And it's inescapable, the difference between that person's youth and your youth or mine. So if we don't understand that, then all our, quote, life experience is not going to worth nothing to nobody when they come rolling up our driveway in absolute and utter despair, right? So it's something like suicide. You know, this is thin ice, what I'm going to say now. But probably you've been with people that you knew were close, were thinking about it,
yep.
Or stronger than thinking about it.
Yep.
And the general notion in the population is if you just make the case that the sun will come up and it's a wonderful world, they won't even think about it again. Like they've never thought of that themselves. So here's the point. The sun coming up is not enough sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. And you getting another kick at the can is not enough to keep you here, right? And if you happen to be 23 and looking at the world that somebody my age is about to hand over to you and wish you a good day, I mean, I'm not sure how those kids mobilize. Well, one of the ways they mobilize is they're possessed of a kind of sort of low grief, high intense animosity kind of emotional spectrum. And they're ready to take it out on somebody. And more often than not, it's somebody twice or three times their age. And that's what you got to be ready for. If you want a young kid to come up your driveway in hopes that there's something at the end of the driveway at your front door, you got to be, I think, ready for what they're going to be bringing. And the degree of frank betrayal that they have come to life, understanding that they are on the receiving end from us, of is it's really unspeakable, frankly. And people who propose to be somebody's elder have a fundamental responsibility to speak the betrayal that has ensued since the 60s, I will say. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Orphanwisdom.com is a good site to check out. Stephen Jenkinson is who we're chatting with. Stephen, within the evangelical church, there seems to be, especially in the United States, more so there than anywhere else in the world, there seems to be some kind of toxicity that begins to occur as someone is honored with the title of elder, and others look up to them for spiritual direction, advice, or counsel. And it might be because in the States, especially in the Jesus scene, that you get this clash of cultures. You get the mega church culture and the celebritydom culture, right? The worship of celebrity. And it happens. And then these guys end up tanking. The wheels fall off.
Too much to carry.
Yeah, yeah. So if the Jesus people aren't getting this...
Oh, dear. Yeah. If they can't get it right...
You know, well, I'm saying, like, there's some good examples of spiritual direction. I get what they're trying to do. I was part of that tribe for a few decades. I get what they're trying to do, but I just, my leanings are more towards a Seinfeld-esque wisdom. In other words, you know, I don't know. Like, what's wrong with I don't know? Let's look at this stuff together. And I don't, like, you're coming to me for answers because you have claimed I'm an answer man. Well, stop it. That's whack.
Yeah, you got to be a better question man or woman.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
This is where, first, two things about wisdom. First of all, well, there's a lot of things, but two that I'm thinking of now. One of them is, you know, far from being, quote, eternal, it is in the nature of wisdom itself to be absolutely topical and transient. By which I mean that it's every age's fundamental sort of spiritual project to come to the world that is recently inherited and to fashion for itself a reason for its generation existing at all. That's what I mean by spiritual project. So how can wisdom possibly be inherited when the fundamentals are oncoming? They're not enduring for all time. They're oncoming. And in our time, probably more than any other time in any kind of recorded history, this is true. So there's the abiding reality of wisdom, is that it's forever changing its face and changing its voice and changing its location and its appeal. So the fundamental work then is inquiry, not answering.
Yeah.
Right? As you've just said, I agree with you. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, I don't know you. But I'm just hearing now that they're, you know, you're leaving the airwaves. I think I'm going to miss you. Just so you, if you haven't heard that, you heard it today.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thanks. I I've spent 16 years asking questions. I was a question asker before I came into the position. I just happened to figure out a way to make a little money off of asking questions. Mm-hmm. But I got complacent. I think I painted myself into a corner. Mm-hmm. And there's a part of my, I don't know if it's just like the dude thing again or what it is, but like, I was like, man, after 16 years, you got to know something. Why don't you go write a book about what you know? And as I've been thinking about this, it turns out I know jack. I just don't. And I contrast these things. And by the way, this is all in the context of a discussion of elders. The rabbi's job description is to ask questions with the congregation, with their people. Mm-hmm. The pastor's job description is to be the answer man. Mm. I want to hang out with Jews more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My first marriage, I married in, so I had a little inside track on some of that stuff for a while.
Well, which tribe did you marry into?
Jewish.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yes.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how about this one? I'm listening to, you probably know the guy's name. I think he's Israeli. He wrote a book that was a megaton event, something about the brief history of humanity or the world or something like that. And then
Mel Brooks?
No. But anyway, and then recently came out with a kind of sequel. What would that be? Well, the near future, I guess. I don't know the name of the book, but I'm listening to, he's being interviewed on the mothership, the CBC. And the first question the guy asks him is, what do you see coming? And he said, well, they're working on a serum. I don't know if you've heard this, it's going to sound like science fiction. And judging by the sound of your voice, he says to the interviewer, it's probably too late for you. But still, there's a serum. You take the serum, you won't have to die. So there's the first thing to observe. You won't have to die. How about saying you take the serum, you won't be able to die? Does that change the complexion of the thought? It certainly does. You won't be able to die. Watch where this goes next. So the guy says to him, so if we won't die, then what will become of us? And the man said, well, first of all, he said, we might have to come up with a new category. And the word human might not quite fit those people who don't have to die. Maybe, he said, those people will be divine. That's the word he used. And you could hear everybody in the studio audience going, oh, just nobody's tolerating that. But think about it for a second. Well, you know, most people's understanding of divine includes what? Not going anywhere anytime soon. Right, it's never going to end.
Right,
something like immortality. Mm-hmm. Not surprising. So then, if you flip it on its head, you ask yourself, well, what makes us human if not being able to die might make us divine? And the answer is, every ending, every limit that came our way, that was our chance to be human. And when you think about how those things are cursed and shamed and rejected and out of hand, abandoned, it's frankly shameful, right? That this is what elders fundamentally are so good at being limited, not being somebody else's limit, but themselves embodying, you know, the very end of all possibilities and the incarnation of one. You become, it's like getting married, you become one thing in order to not keep all the options open, and in so doing, be nothing at all. That's what elderhood is. It's deciding to be one thing. You end up as something and have forsaken all of the could-a-bes that you entertained for some period of time. And there's some extraordinary bravery in a time like ours, it seems to me, in being willing to do that. It's not settling exactly, unless you understand settling to be crafting the ability to be at home when all about you are lunging and seeking after any kind of solace in a storm.
Stephen Jenkinson is making me sound like I'm having a stroke here. If meaning is not found, but rather made.
Made, yeah.
Then how has Stephen Jenkinson made meaning?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm the child of fortune. That's the first thing. I'm a young guy. I go to Harvard. They don't let me into the Master of Divinity program because I'd never been to church. It's kind of a goofy story, but it's true. And I didn't know that being to church was a prerequisite of being a minister. So a little naive, obviously. But they wouldn't have me. And things have worked out desperately well since then, to the point where occasionally I'm in front of a church and I'm being paid my normal exorbitant fee, and I get to tell the story that you wouldn't have me once. Now you got to pay through the nose. So I don't quite mean that, but somewhere in there I meet an old black man who's a storyteller. That's what he does with his life. Doesn't sound like much until you're with him, and I was with him for a 7-year undeclared apprenticeship. And in those 7 years, I was exposed to what a flagrant human being can be and do. And it raised the kind of standard of expectation for me that was absolutely tyrannical for about 10 or 15 years. I couldn't live with it because everything I did or tried to imagine myself doing simply didn't live up to the one, you know, gleaming human example that I was lucky enough to see. And it, you know, I was lucky that I didn't die young. I didn't die even in middle age. I'm going to be 65 this year, and my great good fortune is I lived long enough to recognize what an immense blessing it was to be held to that kind of standard without seeking it. That's what happened to me. And somewhere in there of contending with his example and at times hating him for his capacity to stand and deliver the way he did, because he never asked permission. He was one of those guys that occasionally asked for forgiveness but really never asked for permission. And in a time like ours, well, that's the kind of sort of shadowy wisdom that I, for one, find immensely important now. So when you see it, you can debate with it, but you really can't debate it. And by the time I got to the death trade and started working with dying people, everything that I'd seen with him started to come around, started to announce itself, declare itself, and make itself known to me, make itself lucid, really for the first time in my life. Meanwhile, I've had a divorce. Meanwhile, I got my kids on the weekend and I'm renting a motel room to do it. I mean, everything looked grim and impossible. At the same time, as I was beginning to glimpse the kind of God-givenness of limits, at somewhere in there, I suppose I came to my senses finally, after having had come to other people's senses for a while. And somewhere in there, I ended up on a Drew Marshall show.
Oh, beautiful.
Circle of life.
Good tagline there. Yeah, circle of life. Okay, so I want to come back to a question I'm trying to think of how you would answer it.
Okay.
And it's hurting me. So I'm just going to put that one on pause just for a second. And I want to go to this, this thing first. The self-help industry or the growth industry or the, what's another name for the term?
Sheep.
Positive, the sheep. Yeah. And they have a retreat here and a retreat there and come and, you know, and retreat from life. And people, especially I've met so many in their 30s who are into the yoga retreat stuff. And basically what I hear them all saying is, okay, hold on a second. Hold on. The world sucks. So I'm going to disappear and I'm going to retreat from all things worldly and I'm going to get my fecal matter together and then I'm going to come back and I'll help.
Right.
And there's something that bugs me about that. And I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet. Maybe the privilege thing kind of comes into play here. But, dude, you're part of that. Like, you work both sides of the fence. You kind of slag that scene as well. But at the same time, people go to some whatever Costa Rican jungle and listen to you. They sit at your feet. And so there's a weird dichotomy there.
Yeah, it's not that way, though.
Oh, it's not?
The second part of the characterization.
Okay.
First of all, I've never been to Costa Rica, but... Not that counts for your point, I understand. But nobody sits at my feet. And the third thing is, I'm a white guy from Scarborough, Ontario. You can't get less exotic than me.
You and Geddy Lee.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's funny.
No, that's all true.
Yeah.
So, and the fourth thing is, if I'm keeping track here, I don't retreat. See, I'm not, the world is hard. But the world doesn't suck. This is it, baby. And we were entrusted with this thing. But I'm with you 100% on this notion of... We just did a screening of Griefwalker in Oaxaca, in Mexico. I hope... Don't count that against me now. Because it wasn't a nice day, if that helps at all.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
And it wasn't a big crowd. It was about 80 or 90 people. But the guy comes up to me after. He's all dressed in white. Here it comes. And he's in his early 30s, and he's an expat from Germany, and he's got it all figured out.
Yeah.
So he's going to tell me how, and that was his line, exactly what you said. You got to get your stuff together first, and then you can be relied upon. And I just looked at him, I said, so we got to wait then.
Yeah.
And he stopped for a second, and he wasn't sure what I meant. I said, you know exactly what I mean. We got to do the heavy lifting until you feel better about yourself. Okay, and you think the magic's going to come, the magic day when you'll look up from your self-absorption and know that you've done it enough. What makes you think there's a statute of limitations on being fascinated with your own misery? There isn't one, from what I can tell. So it's not going to, you're not going to click over the odometer of self-hatred and be okay suddenly, and then be useful to the rest of us. So what then? Well, it's like this: join the fray now, and maybe some aspect of joining the fray will double back towards you and give you, you know, a kind of occasional day off to wonder about yourself. Mm-hmm. But the world is not an extension of yourself. That's not where it comes from. You think about the Serenity Prayer. There's people listening. I'm gonna have to mess with it. Whose life has been saved, perhaps, by their Serenity Prayer, and I don't diminish that. But I'll say this: if you investigate the tone of the thing, you'll come to the understanding, among others, that it's a kind of three-headed hydra, the Serenity Prayer. It's asking for three things, and it's rotating around an axis that it doesn't cop to, that it doesn't admit. And the axis is this: everything in human life can come down to what you can control and what you can't. Now that is self-absorption. It sounds like a recipe for peace of mind, but it's the kind of peace of mind that's predicated on, can you control it? Then control it. Can you not control it? Forget about it. And then occasionally, if you get confused, a little wisdom to tell the difference. Last time I checked, the world is so vast and so properly complicated that it doesn't answer to the description of whether or not we can control it. It's far beyond that miserly repertoire that we bring to it. So retreating, I guess you could say, you know, the self-hatred that's around these days amongst white folks in particular is our version of self-absorption. It's not the solution to it. It's not us getting off the merry-go-round of self-absorption because we finally get and we realize how miserably unable we are. It's more of the same, which is why I made that case about privilege. Mm-hmm. You know, we just understand that we were born into a remarkable circumstance, and we can't infer from that any merit accrues to us because we were born like this. That's all. It doesn't say anything about us, but now it asks something of us. That's the difference. No shame is necessary to be mobilized by your understanding of being on the receiving end of privilege. None at all.
I've got a guy who sits across the board from me here, and
I'm beautiful, by the way.
Oh, would you stop it? His name is Tim. We call him Tim the Tool because he makes an enormous amount of mistakes every show. And
I thought you were going to say money.
Yeah, no, he does not make a lot of money. He's a school teacher.
Oh, there you go.
Which is one of the reasons why I stopped watching professional sports, to believe it or not, Tim. It's just when I contrast what they make as compared to what you guys make. Mm-hmm. Seriously.
Oh, is that a good thing or a bad thing? You think I'm overpaid?
No, stop it. I'm saying that. Anyway, Tim is sitting here. He's got a T-shirt on, and his shirt says, God hates figs. And it's got all these scripture verses where God condemns a fig tree and it withers up and dies. You know, yeah. The guy that started that whole thing, Fred Phelps, GodHatesFags.com, I had him on the show a number of years ago. He's dead now.
Maybe he knows better. Who knows?
Maybe
he's sitting on the rainbow in the sky.
But anyway, Tim, you were bugging me because you wanted to say something.
One of the things I've come to realize over the last couple of years, one of the things I've had the privilege of teaching is improv, because I teach drama, and there's three sort of foundational rules that I think are part of improv, and I think actually are really wonderful for life. I'd be interested in hearing what you think about them. Mm-hmm. One is everybody on stage is more important than you. So you got to take care of everybody first. The other one is yes and. So accept what's happening and then build on it. Whether what's happening is good on stage, you got to say okay, and then you work with it, you build on it. And the last one, I think, which actually applies to Drew in a lot of ways right now with what's happening in his life, is follow the fear. If it scares you, lean into it. Don't walk away from it. Does any of that...
Are you saying I'm afraid of my wife?
No. No, I'm saying, like, when people ask you that question, what are you doing next? And you don't answer. I'm saying your answer is you are following the fear.
Yeah.
Do any of these things...
Stephen Jenkinson, are those three things awesome that Tim just said?
No, I want to know if they... I'll shut up.
Okay.
Just going with what Drew said before, if you don't have an answer, that's okay.
Yeah. Is it my turn?
Yes.
Yes, and.
Okay, yes, and, very good. Okay, well, you followed the fear and asked me the question.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, no, it seems to me that one of these things, that the list that you gave is in part a kind of road to a kind of success. So just in and of itself, it made me a little leery.
Okay.
You know, that it's strategy, yeah, recipe, not so great to me, right? But if, you know, to take them one at a time, I can't even remember all of them, actually, but the fear thing, well, it's proper, I think, to, at the end of that aphorism, to say, still fearful, though. In other words, it's not a way of overcoming the fear, such that it, I mean, fear is legit, right? It belongs. It's got to be there. So, and it's a sign that you get it. Just like despair, to a certain degree, is a sign that you get it. What were the other two?
For me, it's like improv keeps moving forward, so you're always following the fear. There's not an end to it, ultimately. Yeah. The other one is everybody on stage is more important than you.
Yeah, that's a strange formulation to me.
Okay.
I don't know why we need the kind of formal arrangement of importance. We could certainly say everybody on the stage is as on the stage as I am.
Hmm. Well, and, I like that, yeah.
And it would be excruciating if I was one man showing and there's other people there. That'd be excruciating. Not only bad form, but in every way. So so you could just maybe take down the tone of hierarchy or importance.
I can see that, yeah.
Right, and just replace it with the notion that, like, you're an animist. That's a recipe for animism, really. And, I mean, it's a beautiful formulation, the notion that the world is alive and, as such, has a requirement of us that all living things do, which is that we marshal our humanity in favor of life, because it doesn't always go that way, which is why we have this word human, and then we have this other word humane.
Mm.
And what's the difference between the two? And one of them is, well, you're always human, but alas, not always humane.
Oh, yeah.
Right, which is a terrible failing that seems to be part of our circuitry. And we seem to be the only life form that on occasionally draws an utter blank about how to be itself.
Hmm. Stephen, what's wrong with you?
Well, you got to have me back on. We're going to do justice to that.
No, seriously, because you're... I'll celebrate this fact. I meet a lot of interesting people. I get to simply because I have a microphone.
Yeah.
Not because of anything I've done. I just, you know, there are a lot of listeners. Okay. Meet a lot of people, talk to a lot of interesting people. Mm. But there's something wrong with you.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I don't know what it is. I'm just saying, dude, if you were like this as a kid, you must have got beat up a lot.
No, but I didn't get out a lot.
You didn't get out a lot?
No, this is not... This is not heavily sought after stuff in high school.
No.
Right?
So, I mean, are you leaking this stuff simply because you have been a voracious reader and you live life eyes wide open? I mean, have you ever done... This is a jerk question.
Mm.
You ever done a real job?
Well, I think trying to help people die well was a real job.
I know. No, I love that, too. Like, I'm a hospital chaplain. I grew up in the funeral business. I was a pastor. I've been at the bedside of many who have left.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's still not normal. That's why people are interested in the stories that I share about those moments, those thin places, as the Celts would call them.
Well, how about this? Maybe... What you meant by real job is, have I been chronically employed in stuff I didn't believe in or
yes.
couldn't love?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what you... And yes. Isn't that a tragic definition of a real job?
Yeah, but man, those are my heroes. The meathead who's working at the factory in Hamilton, the steel plant, who isn't sitting around, you know, downloading Oprah podcasts, trying to peel back the layers on his psyche or his motivation behind. He's just putting the food on the table, man.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys I admire. Not all of them, because some of them are jerks. But what I'm talking about is just that stickability. When you do something that you don't want to do in order to provide or love those who you love, to support those who you love, I admire that so much. Instead of this, I got to go get my life coach certificate and I'm 32.
Okay, but Drew, those are not the only two options available to us.
Oh, that's true.
Okay, meatheads or life coaches. I mean, you've been watching Uncle Archie Bunker too much.
Archie Bunker.
I wouldn't say it's the measure of a legitimate enterprise to hate doing it while you're doing it or to put up with it. You know, I said at the beginning, I'll say it again. I got lucky in there somewhere. Not because, quote, I didn't have to work at the kind of job you described, mm-hmm. but there's something in what was entrusted to me and what I was bedeviled by that turned everything I did into something that meant something to me. Hmm. So what do you call that? I mean, I can't take credit for it.
No.
You know, and it's not like, I mean, all of us tend to head towards things that we find in some fashion or other compelling, and some of us find them, right? And periodically I found them. But I'm not coaching anybody. I don't have a shingle out saying, you know, bring your misery. As we were introduced one time, we were doing the Grief and Mystery show, and dude gets on the stage and says, and now, a night of grief and misery. And I said, whoa.
No, that's how they introduced the ABBA cover bands. Man.
Mamma mia.
Okay, Stephen, how does our current culture learn to have elders in our midst?
By this. I don't have a recipe for it, but I have an instinct about it.
Okay.
Wouldn't it be something if rather than trying to get the certificate and the T-shirt and the gold watch and all the recognition and the day off, and all of that we would imagine would accrue to elderhood, that we set about at any age being willing to recognize the elder function when we see it and hold it in some kind of high esteem, even though it doesn't reflect very immediately or positively upon us personally. That's part of the answer. You know, being grateful for stuff that's in the world that doesn't benefit you in any obvious and direct way.
Yeah.
Is a pretty significant part of that arrangement. It's there. The elderhood function is there, but it's not. It doesn't live in a personality type. That means, I think it's, you know, we have this expression, make a beeline. And we think it means to head somewhere directly. Well, we've got bees on the farm, I'm telling you. They don't know how to move directly anywhere. So what they're doing is they pass back and forth through the pollen trail, right? And they narrow down the possibilities as they go dart back and forth across it until they finally lock into it. And that's what elderhood is. It passes back and forth through the various possibilities that the time is asking of them until it's in their nose more than it's not. That's my guess. And somewhere in there, you know, you've tried everything but being drawn to legitimate elderhood. An elder will ask so much of you that the chance of you coming back twice aren't great.
That's
so
really good.
Elderhood is the undoing of this life coach thing that you're obviously quite concerned about.
Yes. It's a passion of mine.
It's the end of it.
Yeah. Well, when I grow up, I would like to not only have a smidgen of the wisdom that leaks out of you, but I would also like to have a smidgen of your writing abilities. That's my next season. I would like to just write. You know, I'm laying there each day. You know, you're laying there at night and you got so much stuff spinning in your head and you got to get up and write it down before you can go to sleep. That's like I've had 16 years of thoughts spinning around my head as a result of all these interviews. It's time to shut up and write stuff down.
Well, good luck with that. It's not how it seems from the outside. I promise you that. I've done it four or five times now. I'm doing it again right now.
Yeah.
I'm writing a book about matrimony. Yeah, man. I thought this is the one I was going to be sort of calm and relaxed, And I realize I have to take on this whole identity politics thing. So this is going to be the most rancorous thing I've ever written.
My wife and I just renewed our vows in Mexico a couple of weeks ago after
being separated. Look who's going to Mexico.
Yeah, come on.
It's a God-given moment.
The weather was bad. Don't worry.
The weather was bad.
I'm going to trash you now.
I got diarrhea. Does that count?
Runs in the family.
It's privileged diarrhea that you got.
Yes. Oh, man. You have been a highlight reel for me. Thank you. I get asked a lot. You know, ooh, tell us about some guests that are really amazing in the show and stuff. And again, I'll say it like I said at the start of this interview. You are an irritating pebble in my soul.
Well, there's something about you that brings out the best in more people than not. I'll bet anything that's true because I'm experiencing it in the last, you know, however long it's been, 45 minutes or something. And I hope somewhere along the line there you take some credit. You know, simply to realize who you're talking to. I mean, that in and of itself is an immense skill. And if you do it all the time, how do you not be on autopilot and it's clear that you're not. And it's a high wire act, what you do, if this is any indication. And most people would be unnerved by it. But I find I'm nerved by it. By the way you are and the way you ask these things. And I really appreciate the accolade. And I would just say back to you, because this only happens, no matter how, quote, good I might be able to be, if you're not willing to go there too and have the ability to go there too, I can't go there by myself.
Yeah.
And I've known that. You know it. You know how this works. It's an alchemy thing. And we're lucky when it happens. And it doesn't always happen. But when it does, you can look up and you say, still alive. I remember the last one. And it's when they said I was coming on again, I said, wow, nobody's crossed him off the list yet. Amazing.
Yeah.
But you're going on your own terms. It's really good. I'm glad to hear it because I didn't get that chance. But, would it be so that something in your writing... ask something of you that's not simply reporting on what you heard or what you saw or
who came. Exactly. No. You know. You're right on about that.
Yeah, that it's something that hasn't appeared yet.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
That's what I feel simmering. Mm. So, listen, I've got a lot of friends in Australia. I used to live there. I was there for 5 years. I used to be in a pastor up in a church in the Blue Mountains, and you're going to Wentworth Falls.
Yes, I am.
So for all my friends in Australia, go see this dude. And also, Christchurch, New Zealand, our next guest, her name is Lilia Tarawa. I think that's how you pronounce her last name. She's the author of Daughter of Gloriaville, My Life in a Religious Cult. Mm. We're going to be speaking to her from Christchurch. Mm. So I'm going to plug your gig over there as well with her.
Listen, can I just invite you and as a guest? We're probably going to do 5 nights. We have a grief and mystery tour coming up. Mostly in the States, but we're going to end the tour with 5 nights in Toronto at a theater we're renting. And if you're in town, you're in Toronto?
I live just outside in the country, but close enough.
If you can make it in, it's in late November, early December, somewhere in there.
Okay.
And it'd be great to meet you, and you please come and see the show and let me know what you think of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen.
Beautiful.
Have a good weekend, man.
I'll do at least that, and I won't stop there if you don't.
Okay, I won't. Thank you.
Man.
Thank you, Stephen.
Blessing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
You'll be the misery part of that presentation.
I know.
Just so you know, you're a pebble for me, but not my shoe.
Oh, thank you. So kind. I mean, that's how you end it. You have to end it with a little grumpy voice guy here.
Leonard Cohen, you want it darker.
Yeah. Stephen Jenkinson, activist, teacher, farmer, author of Come of Age, The Case of Elderhood in a Time of Trouble. There's a guy whose entire series of books I would highly recommend to anybody, even 23-year-old interns.